You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the 10th voice.
This is the 10th voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th voice, because you refuse to be silent.
This is Elizabeth Anderson. It is the second Saturday of the 10th voice, so it is the Sandra Moran Radio Book Club, and today we will be discussing Janet Mock's memoir, Redefining Realness, My Path to Womanhood, Identity, Love, and So Much More. As I said on my Facebook page today, my aim with the show, and it was Sandra Moran's, is to have books from the entire LGBT community, have diverse panels, and have intelligent discussions about well-written books. Last year we did a transgender author's book, Thomas Page McBee's Man Alive. The panel was all transgender, and we had panelists Luke Harness, Samantha Ruggles, Sandra Mead, and Dana Wheeldon. This time also we have a relatively diverse panel, and I want to introduce our panelists, and again we're talking about Janet Mock's Redefining Realness. Una, would you like to describe yourself?
Yes, I'm Una Nowling. I am also one of the hostesses of the 10th Voice, but not today. I consider myself to be a transgender lesbian woman.
And Samantha?
Hi, I work at the Kansas City Center for Inclusion, and I identify as a transgender woman.
And are you on the line? Ann Terpstra.
I'm a cis woman and identify as a lesbian. I am also an author of queer fiction.
Thank you. I should say what I am or how I see myself. I am a lesbian. I don't mind being called bisexual because I was married to a man, my son's dad, for 17 and a half years. And I don't mind the word queer. I'm fine with being called queer, and I'm also fine with being called a gay woman. So we have a panel that is going to discuss this memoir. It's very, very interesting. And I'd like to start out with a question, and Anne, I'll throw it to you first. Do you read memoirs? What kinds of memoirs do you enjoy reading? And if not, what genres do you read?
I read pretty broadly. I do read memoirs, but I wouldn't call myself necessarily a memoir expert. Two recently that I've really enjoyed were Just Kids by Patti Smith, which is one of the sort of came to without a lot of expectation and was just blown away by. And then both of Alison Bechdel's graphic novels, Fun Home being the most well-known one that's now a Broadway musical, I've read recently, and I thought that was just terrific. And I thought it was the first graphic novel I read as a memoir, and I thought that medium worked really well for it.
Thank you. Samantha, how about you?
Now that I think about it, this may be, I'm sure I have read memoirs, but I'm not. I do read quite a bit of different subject matters, but I think this was my first memoir, certainly as of late, and certainly the first memoir from a transgender perspective that really resonated with me, you know, from a lot of aspects. Certainly not locale or place, but some of the struggles, some of the identities and feelings that she had at a very young age, I could relate to those as well.
Una?
I am a transgender historian, and as a result, I actually have read probably about 60 or 70 different memoirs from transgender women and men over the years, and I probably have another 40 that are still in my to-read list. So, yes, I do that very extensively. And so when I read Janet Mock's book, I could find many places where I could pick out common themes from memoirs of other transgender persons from as far back, literally, as the early 19-teens, but also with a significant amount of newness to it, dealing with her specific experience and her take on her transition and her life.
I have to admit that because of this show, I've always loved memoirs, but I've tended to read memoirs, say, of John Huston, white male director, and this show has introduced me to people I probably would not have met otherwise. Charles M. Blow, African-American, Fire Shut Up in My Bones, Richard Blanco, Los Cocuyos of Miami, Daisy Hernandez, A Cup of Water Under My Bed, both Hispanic, Audre Lorde, Zami, and last year, Thomas Page McBee's Man Alive. And I might not have read Janet Mock's book without this show, and now I want to read her new one. I find memoirs are a great way to stretch and go beyond your own experience and try to understand why someone is saying or doing or embodying what they are.
Exactly. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for bringing me into this and having me read this book. I actually had picked this book up at the very first time I went to my therapist 3 years ago. And quite honestly, when I looked at it, I thought it was memoirs of a woman. And certainly it is, but at that time, you know, a term I didn't have was cisgendered woman. Being able to be at this place in my transition and in my life, to be able to read this now and reflect on what I've been through was very enlightening, very inspirational, and very very good. Thank you.
And Una, you had read this book before, is that correct?
Yes, I read it last year, and I had to brush up a little bit for this, but I had read it. And again, you know, like I said, because I've read so many of them, it all sort of fits together into a tapestry of trans life, whether it's transgender women, transgender men, non-binary or non-conforming transgender people. I think, you know, her book was very important for adding some additional threads to the mental tapestry that I've developed from the research that I've done.
Anne, what about you?
I was familiar with Janet as a personality, you know, through the media and Twitter. I was not familiar with her story, and I really enjoyed the book, and I think what really struck me is, you know, she talks in the book at one place about trans narratives not being just about the transitioning, just as queer stories aren't just about coming out. There's so much more to our stories than that. And I think her book clearly illustrates that that is true, because although realizing her identity, taking this step to transition are definitely key parts of the book, so much of her story is about her personal journey through childhood and very challenging circumstances. And, you know, I think if someone just said, oh, tell me your transition story to Janet Mock, they're missing out on just a huge conversation about her life in a variety of ways.
And I think one thing that a memoir can do is redefine or clarify points. There were aspects of this book, for instance, her story as really a young person, because she started seeing herself as a girl very, very early. And she, I think it was seventh grade that she started presenting as herself. I found that fascinating that she was doing it in Hawaii, because a film I've seen three times is Kumuhina. Una, I see you nodding your head.
Yes, I really enjoy that film. I helped review it for KCPT Channel 19 here when they had it. But anyways, Kumuhina, about the, you know, a particular Mahu woman of Hawaii, was very enlightening to me, and it really also gave me some insight to help me appreciate the world to some extent that Janet Mock was growing up in.
You know, and even in seventh grade when she started expressing herself, she actually got called into the principal's office a few times, and she was sent home to change, and she'd come back the next day expressing herself again. And she figured out ways to maneuver through the high school and school and to express herself how she felt she wanted to, and did a very good job of it.
Anne?
No, I agree. And I was struck by how early she kind of understood who she was. That was not a realization that I had in terms of my lesbianism nearly that early, and so that it very much impressed me, and she had such strength of that conviction and kind of moving forward with that. I was also struck by, I get the sense that where she was in Hawaii, although Hawaii has bigger cities, is a small community, and, you know, having come from a very small community, the fact that she was able to find Wendy and find people who looked like her or who looked where she wanted to be going was so fortunate. I felt like I was just impressed with how she found those people and was able to sort of move forward with them, because coming from a small town, it's very hard to find people who look like you or who present the way you would like to present, or, you know, even just feel the way you feel when you meet them. So I think that was such a great blessing of being in Hawaii versus where she was, like in Oakland, being able to find that community even on that small island.
Let's talk about being in Oakland, being in Dallas, and being in Hawaii. The reason she moved to those places was her family. Let's talk about her parents and her siblings a little bit. Which parent or which sibling particularly stood out to you? Una?
Yeah, the story of how her family and her relationship changed. I was struck by how there was was a change in her family's relationship, watching the evolution of their growing acceptance of her over time. It was sort of like two steps forward, one step back. There's almost something I was reading behind the scenes as I was reading about her family relations, where it seemed like she was trying not to talk about some of the mistakes and some of the intolerant points and really just focus on the positive. And I think that the fact that she did end up with some support gave her a significant advantage and really helped her out.
Samantha?
You know, both her mother and father, you know, the relationships they had were, you know, strained at times and strong at times. And I think that speaks to the relationships we have with a lot of people. Sometimes they're good. Sometimes we learn. Sometimes they come back. Sometimes they don't. One thing I was impressed with was the relationship with her brother, Chad. They were two brothers growing up together at the early ages. And, you know, Chad, though, you know, they stayed close through it all and was very supportive, even in high school, when Chad somewhat did remove himself from, not from supporting her, but just the questions that he would get, you know, from other people in the high school. But he still stayed strong to her personally. You know, that kind of spoke to some of the relationships I have with my brother, which are essentially non-existent. And be able to see those two work through that. The other thing that struck me was when, and it was somewhat late in her transition, I think she'd already even started on hormone therapy, when she finally told her mother that she was a girl. I was like going down, you know, reading real fast, and, you know, oh my gosh, she's going to tell her mom. Oh my God. Mom says, whatever you need. And I like that.
Ann?
No, I agree. I found the relationship with the brother interesting. I kind of feel like I would like to have heard a little more about Chad and kind of how they related. I almost felt like she was sort of protecting his privacy a little in this book, because he's obviously very important to her and they're positive. But there are spaces where he sort of drifted in and out of the narrative, especially as they got older. And I was just curious to hear more about that. It's obviously there's a level of respect and love that's still there, which is great. The other relationship I thought was interesting was her mother, because as Janet was sort of embracing even more of who she was, you know, starting hormones without her parents' knowledge, that kind of thing, her mother's life was essentially falling apart in a lot of ways. And it's kind of an interesting dichotomy that as Janet is moving into being a teenage girl, being a woman, and trying to find out what that identity means to her, you know, her female role model, so to speak, is struggling so much. And I think it's wonderful that they appear to have come out the other side of that, and Janet was able to sort of see those flaws and see that sort of traumatic time as something that could be moved through and come to a place of acceptance.
I found it interesting, too, that each of her parents struggled with drugs. She saw her father with the pipe, cocaine, and then her mother became heavily into drugs when she was with Rick. Chad was mentioned, her brother, and I got the sense he was kind of a rock when her parents were falling away, even though she was older. One thing that really impressed me in a bad way was her father, because he would cut her hair, and she was very proud of her hair, and he would cut it. When she didn't want to ride down the steep hill, he just shoved her, and she hurt herself, and then he basically called her a sissy. I was surprised that her father ever came around to the extent he did.
Well, you know, I understand her story is an ongoing thing, and sometimes families go in, they cycle back and forth a bit. They react immediately with they don't accept you, then they get a sort of a grudging acceptance, and then they fall back again. I've gone through some of that with members of my family, so that's kind of the impression I got of what was happening.
And while there was a lot of differences between Janet and her father as far as the way they went about things, there towards the end when Janet was sharing some of the letters back and forth, that her dad inferred that they were very much alike, that they both were very headstrong, they believed in what they believed in, right or wrong, and they both made strides to reach those. Now, both in different ways, of course, but there was a sense of you're just like me from the father.
What was interesting was he wasn't mad that she was a young woman. He was mad at her tone in telling him. And that I understood, because my father and I have always butted heads on tone, and he disowned me when I came out. And so I found the father very interesting. Anne, what about you?
Yes, she seemed to recognize pretty early on, even. I thought that they had a lot of similarities. You know, the cake baking incident where the cake gets ruined and sort of the ribbing she gets from her father. I think around there she talks about his selfishness, but also realizing that she contained that, and that wanting to be the center of attention, even in childhood, she was recognizing, you know, I'm like this person. And it's interesting because some of those flaws made him a poor parent at times, or at least an absent one. You know, she was able to sort of take some of that selfishness and use it in her own personality to survive and move forward. So I think it was very intelligent of her, or perceptive, I guess is the word I want, to see those flaws and to see that it can be negative to be selfish at times, of course, but there are times that that selfishness can help save you. And I think that did in her case, you know, getting that from him.
Interesting point, because I think of selfishness as a bad thing. But there are times when, to protect yourself, you absolutely have to be.
Yeah.
I want to ask, too, about Wendy, her friend. And I believe they became friends right around middle school. What did you think of Wendy's role in her memoir, Una?
Well, I was jealous that she had someone that's supportive and that, you know, that supportive her in every way, who stayed a friend through her life. When I went to school, I mean, I was even out about my gender identity then, because it was back in the 70s and you just didn't talk about those things. But I never had any friends. There really wasn't any friend I could have even come out to if I wanted to. I thought it was really fantastic for her and must have given her an incredible amount of support. But I've kept getting a little wistful reading any section about it, though, with her, because I wish that I would have had that level of support myself.
Samantha?
I kind of had the same thoughts, Una. You know, growing up in small town Kansas, you don't get, you know, you don't get the opportunity to see other transgender or gender variant individuals. You know, and I did a lot of comparing and contrasting in my mind to, you know, what she was going through. Now, you know, having somebody like Wendy as a, you know, somewhat of an early role model, but someone that was flamboyant and was proud of their flamboyancy and, you know, was out and proud of who they were, and Janet drew from that. And Janet also, you know, got a lot of other draws from other individuals, including the youth center that she attended. But yeah, Wendy was a character. I enjoyed her.
What I liked about Wendy is, anyone had a problem with her dress, anyone had a problem with her talk, anyone had a problem with anything she was doing, she didn't care. I wish I'd had someone like that around me. When I came out almost 25 years ago, I didn't fit. I've talked about it in the past, but I didn't fit at all with other lesbians. A young woman named Holly, who was in her 20s, came up to me and basically befriended me and was my guide into this strange new world I'd entered. And she was very mature, more mature than me in many ways. And I think it's really nice when you do have such a person who steps up. And
no, I agree with the kind of the wistful comment. I actually had no idea that I was lesbian in high school, and so I wasn't necessarily looking for a role model then, but that was one of those things where if I had had one, I might have come to that realization sooner, you know, and Wendy does seem like kind of that, I don't know, miracle friend who everybody would like to meet in high school, because it makes that passage when you're on the margins, you know, much easier to have someone there with you. In my case, it wasn't so much that I felt that I was on the margins in high school, but it was, there wasn't sort of a model to be like, oh, that makes sense. That makes a lot of things make sense I can't put into context. And, you know, Janet already knew, of course, internally, and I'm still impressed at her, the amount of self-knowledge she had even at a young age about that. But meeting Wendy just seemed very serendipitous.
You know, it also, and the reason that I was able to even transition, even late in life at age 43, was because I did have that one true person who was my friend and was also, and still is, my wife, who stood behind me, who encouraged me, who loved me, who was always there for me in every way, shape, and form. And without her assistance and her support and her love is the only reason that I succeeded and did not end up taking my own life instead of being the person that I am today. And she's listening to me right now at home.
And I did have someone like that, and that was my husband. I was about to divorce. We had what my 8-year-old son said was a good divorce. There was very little fighting, no recriminations. We both loved our sons. And as I said, my parents disowned me. He's not someone that usually likes conflict or likes any adversarial position, and he basically said, what is your problem? She's your daughter. I love her. I will always love her. What is your problem? He stood by me. And I think it's real important to have at least that one person who is understanding you're going through something and is going to be there for you. One of the things that I want to talk about is visibility. She was eager to be visible. She wasn't trying to hide. I'd say recent decades was more of a hider. I fit in. I drove a minivan. I had kids. I had a good job. And I didn't even really know who I was. I was just going along. But she wasn't that way. What did you think about that, Una?
Well, I saw quite a few parallels to what I went through in my decision-making process to not live in stealth, you know, not like Janet Mock. Now, I don't look as good as she does, but I have very strong passing privilege. I travel all around the world. People never know I have a transgender history unless I come out to them. And I do come out to them all the time. The person sitting next to me on the plane, if they make the mistake of asking me a question or striking up conversation, by the end of it, they're going to know everything they need to know about transgender people.
And that's a lot of flights.
It is. And I felt a very strong kinship to her in her need to get out there and stand up and be visible and be that person so people can say, that's a transgender person right there. I met one of them. They weren't a monster. They weren't scary or anything. Maybe I'll think twice about, my bigotry.
Samantha, I met you 2 years ago. Think
a little over, maybe
a little over, yeah. At the Like Me Lighthouse, which is now the Kansas City Center for Inclusion. You're on the front desk, you're getting volunteers, you're highly visible. You weren't so much when I first met you.
No, I was pretty shy, but somewhere along the way I realized that visibility saves lives, and that by being authentic, by being visible, by living your truth, that sometimes that's the best you can do. And by doing that, you encourage others. You change minds, you change hearts, you change the narrative. One of the things I liked when she talked about, and there were times when, you know, I think it was shortly after when she went to New York, that she was able to live a semi-stealth life. And then she had to come out to her boyfriend at the time, decided that, you know, it was time. And that's when she started writing her memoirs and had her first interview. And towards the end of the book, there was a quote by Audre Lorde that I liked and highlighted, and that visibility, which makes us vulnerable, is that which also is the source of our greatest strength. I think that's a very good line, that, by being visible, by harnessing that fear, it eventually becomes our strength.
Una, you and I have worked together on this show. You do the fourth Saturday, which is Trans Talk.
Yes.
And how long have you been host now?
I started training in January 2015 under Sandra Mead. And then when Sandra left, it was just me and Luke Harness until September 2015. And I went solo for a little while after that until 2016. I trained my wife, Fiona Nowling, to run the show with me, and we've been co-hosting the Trans Talk show. So literally, I've been here for, I guess, about 2.5, going on 2¾ years.
I think that's really how we met.
Yes.
Is through the show. And I invited her on the show because I liked so much her comments in especially online lesbian fiction groups. There were some very loud, very vocal women who felt everybody should stay in their boxes, and lesbian books can only be written by lesbian authors and should feature lesbian characters. And I really liked what Anne had to say. And in Chicago, I got a chance to meet her last month at the Golden Crown Literary Society and was even more impressed. Anne, do you have any thoughts on this subject?
Well, thank you for the compliment, Elizabeth. I appreciate it. In terms of lesbian fiction, which is more the world where I live, you know, I think that it's about visibility for me happens there a lot in terms of, as you said, speaking out, pushing back against the idea that trans women are not part of the lesbian narrative, which is completely ridiculous, or that a certain type of author has to write a certain type of book. I mean, I've read books that have deeply affected me written by cis white men, you know, and so I think sort of putting a box around who can produce or write what is limiting, and I don't think it serves the queer community, using that term globally in general, very well, because we need all the voices at the table if we're going to tell all these stories. Again, you know, Janet talks in the book about having stories of hope just as much as having stories of sort of truth and context. And, you know, we all, in terms of being visible, hit struggles in life, but there are also many wonderful stories of hope out there. And, you know, one of my goals is to sort of tell that whole truth of that, and that you can be out and visible and happy, because I think the idea still, and it's tapering off, I hope, maybe with, you know, time and generations, is that if you're out, it's automatically going to be a challenging, difficult experience. And being visible for me in my daily life is not a challenge. I mean, it's something I'm very cognizant of. My wife and I are raising a wonderful son, and he's 12. And how we present ourselves to the world and the confidence with which we do that matters, because he watches us for those cues. And however he chooses to identify in the world, I want him to have that confidence to say, this is me, this is who I'm going to be. And, you know, obviously everything should be done with a sense of safety, you know, because not everyone has that. But if you have that sense of safety, it's a wonderful place to move forward from.
While the others are asking why, because family's not only mommy and daddy, it takes love and courage to try, because love makes a family. is love.
This is Elizabeth Anderson. We were just listening to Love is Love, which is a great message. I think we should listen to each other. I think that we should try to cross chasms, build bridges, and not blow them up. And we're going to get more in depth talking about Janet Mock's Redefining Realness. Want to touch on the subject of appearance and presentation. Una?
Yes, Janet's appearance, if I can call her by her Christian name, was very important to her, because especially in the time that she grew up in, as it is now, passing is survival for our community. Not just, it doesn't just allow you to avoid being targeted for victimization, being beaten, being catcalled, or being murdered, like so many other transgender persons of color have been over the years. But it also impacts your ability to survive in employment, your ability to interact with others in society. It makes the difference between a trip to the grocery store just being a trip to the grocery store and one where people are watching you and pointing and whispering and so forth. There has actually been some minor blowback in the transgender community from people that are feeling people like Janet Mock, like Laverne Cox and so forth, or even on a historical standpoint, you know, some of the almost movie star looking women like Christine Jorgensen, they think, well, it's great that they're getting the popularity and they're getting to tell their stories. What about the rest of us slobs out here, you know? And the passing privilege is important to her, and her voice is lovely as well. She obviously spent a large amount of time on that. I've heard her give interviews. Her voice is wonderful, but she doesn't rest on her laurels. She could have submerged. She could have gone stealth and no one would have ever known, but she decided to stand up and say, no, I'm not going to hide. I'm going to be a voice. I'm going to be visible. And that, in my opinion, makes her worthy of a tremendous amount of respect.
I love the way you presented several facets of that. Samantha?
I agree with everything Una said, you know, and everything that, you know, Janet talks about her privilege and she recognizes that. And she even comments in the book about, you know, wanting to be able to to break down that cis-normative goal or that body policing that we have, and that actually, you know, as we break that down, lives are saved, and that, you know, passing does help with, you know, navigating through society, navigating through employment, but that needs to be broken down. You know, I think she talks about it in the book that the misconception in equating the ease of life with passing sometimes does diminish, you know, her experience. The work begins by each of us recognizing that cis people are not more valuable or legitimate than trans people. Yeah, we blend as cis, but that doesn't necessarily equate to we're better than or above you. We must recognize that we all have different experiences of oppression and privilege, and we should be able to use that privilege to the benefit of all.
I think that's an important point. When Una was talking, I remembered something that I'd forgotten. That was in a book club, Literary Lesbians. I had a friend, she's transgender, very tall, and we had all decided to go to Chili's. There must have been about six or seven of us. We became aware that the table right behind us was pointing, laughing, mocking, and it was directed to Marcia. She said, it's okay. I don't mind. It's okay. But clearly, it wasn't okay, and we were uncomfortable. And I got up, and I went over to the table. It was young women, and I said, is there a problem? And they said, no. I said, oh, I was just making sure there wasn't a problem, because if there was a problem, maybe we should talk about it. And they said, no, there's no problem whatsoever. And there was no more attitude during the rest of dinner. But then that was about 2004. And I don't know what made me do that, but I thought, I just can't be this uncomfortable. It's not good for anybody. Marcia said she was okay, but I really don't think she was.
No, I mean, it's, you know, we don't want to stand out for the most part. We don't want to be the object of attention any more than anyone else. So I'm sure it hurt her, you know, unless she was Superwoman, you know, it had to have hurt her.
Anne, what about you? Have you had an experience?
I haven't so much had a personal experience with that, at least not recently. What really struck me from the book was I wrote it down actually because I really liked it. Janet said, realness means you are extraordinary in your embodiment of what society deems normative, which basically, if you break it down, means realness means you look like everybody else. When, to me, realness is, in terms of what is interesting in the world, are the people who stand out, you know, the people who are different, and that sort of, it's derivative then to say, you know, realness basically is a goal when what you're asking people to do is assimilate or not be seen. And so I thought that was an interesting sentence. It really stuck with me because it's about saying, you know, why is the most real thing the thing that makes you invisible or quote-unquote normal in society? You know, you can pass, you cannot be seen, when really don't we all want to be seen for who we are in the world? So I that sentence struck me, and I really like how she approached that.
I didn't get the impression in the memoir that she was saying everybody has to look like her, so I don't want to get that impression. But clearly,
no, she was just, I think she was trying to deconstruct the idea of realness and saying, you know, if realness means passing, you know, that was the term she was using. Basically, what they're saying, you can look like everyone else. And, you know, I think that's absolutely the opposite of what she's encouraging or what she thinks is appropriate.
Thank you,
you. For society.
Thank you for, and I love what you just said. She is gorgeous. Samantha and I both heard her speak at UMKC. She's got gorgeous long hair. She's got gorgeous dresses. She has a budget that allows her to buy, you know, beautiful clothes. And as a lesbian, I had a little bit of a problem with that being the epitome of female, the epitome of womanhood, because I went the opposite direction as a lesbian. I said, I'm never wearing a dress again. I don't like them. I'm not wearing hose. For me, it was being able to down dress. And recently, I felt best, and you were there at Golden Crown, when just for the heck of it, I was dared to. I dressed as Emma Peel in faux leather jacket, faux leather pants, and knee-high boots, which is kind of the opposite of how Janet Mock presents. So how does a real woman dress, Una?
Well, I know how I dress. I do dress to assimilate at work because there's a certain amount of fashions. I work at the executive level at a large corporation, so that my dress is skirt suits, hose, heels most of the days, or sometimes, you know, a maxi skirt or something like that. I get alternative praise for how I look from about half the community. The other half of the community comes out and says, well, you're just reinforcing a heteronormative, you know, cis stereotype. So is every other woman in my office. You know, you don't, there is a time and a place when some level of assimilation is required for survival. If I dyed my hair in a pink mohawk and covered myself in piercings and tats and wore ripped shirts to the office, I wouldn't last a day. And my career is very important to me. It helped keep me alive in the dark times when I had nothing else, and I do a good job, and I like to present well to clients. And I always, you know, I don't wear a pin on my suit that says, you know, kiss me, I'm trans, but I always use every opportunity as a representative there to tell them when we're in small talk time, by the way, did you know that I'm a transgender woman? You know, this is interesting. Let's talk about it.
I had the opposite experience. I was dressing up as a medical editor because it was a dressy type environment. And when I went to work at a trucking association, they thought I was constantly interviewing because I was too dressy. So I learned to dress casually because it fit better. So it was kind of different. Samantha, I've seen you in dresses. And I've seen you in jeans, so I'm guessing you dress how you want to dress.
That's very well said. That's pretty much it. You know, I look in the closet, see what's clean, and, you know, I think about what I'm doing that day. You know, but I also think about, you know, when I grew up, you know, it was a very, very binary world for at least where I was. But I also think, you know, especially in this book, I was thinking about, you know, how I grew up, how I interacted with other children when I was young. I didn't really even think about gender, you know. I guess today I might be considered somewhat gender neutral, gender fluid. I'd play with girls. I'd play with the boys. I'd play, you know, G.I. Joe. I'd play with Easy Bake Ovens. I'd, you know, just do what I felt like was having fun. It wasn't until, you know, around middle school when we started picking teams that I go, ooh, which I got to go over here. But as far as I dress, you know, I think Una's right. You know, you have to dress to make you feel comfortable in your own skin. Even growing up, you know, pre-transition, I wore suits and ties back in the late 80s, early 90s. We had a choice of either a white shirt or a blue shirt. And times have changed, you know, business casual. But then, you know, when I transitioned, it actually became much more enjoyable to dress because there's so many more choices.
I was very angry as a young girl because I grew up in the 50s and was not allowed to wear pants. I had to wear dresses. I didn't want to wear a dress. I was a tomboy. In fact, I'm wearing a tomboy girl shirt
yes,
right now. And I didn't think I was a boy, but I wanted those privileges. I wanted to have a BB gun. I wanted to skip doing dishes because my brother didn't have to. I wanted to wear jeans. I wanted to wear boots. And my parents said, absolutely not. And I threw fits until I was 12 and got a pair of Wranglers and a cowboy shirt. And then I felt more like myself and I was happier. And what about you?
Yeah, I think, you know, growing up, I was also a tomboy. I think I would present as what people call soft butch now. I don't know. I call it like mom clothes that I can run around in. So on a daily basis, jeans and t-shirts, I really like to dress up. You know, I'll put on the sharp suit or I'll wear a dress. It sort of depends on the mood. So I'm a little more flexible that way. But generally, I definitely skew towards what you would consider soft butch or just, you know, jeans and that kind of thing. It's interesting, though, because it can be really dependent on where you live. Like, if we went back to my small town in Iowa where I'm from, and my wife is just like, half of these women look like lesbians. I'm like, I know, practical farm wives look a lot like lesbians.
They do.
So, I mean, it's a lot of the, and I'm not diminishing anyone by saying that. I'm just saying, like, you know, what is normative to wear? You know, jeans and practical shoes and a t-shirt is what a lot of straight women wear depending on their job or where they live or whatever. So, you know, growing up, because it was more the 70s, 80s for me, I didn't have that 50s problem that you did, Elizabeth, with my parents expecting me to always be in a dress. My mother certainly experienced that. So I had more flexibility as a kid, but I definitely skewed tomboy. And, you know, when dress things came around, my parents had to kind of push me into them. So it was more of a relief, you know, getting older to be able to sort of say, no, I'm going to wear this dress now because I want to, versus you're going to wear it today because I told you to.
Right. I want to jump off from the subject of appearances to talk about the fact that I get the impression that even as a teenager, she was beautiful. And I had very mixed feelings reading about her sex work. She makes the point, particularly in the last part of the book, that she had a purpose. She wanted a college education. She also wanted to have surgery, and she did at 18, and she needed to earn money. And at one point, her family was homeless. They were living in a motel room, and she was sharing a bed with a sibling. And it was her choice, and she was going to do it. But I had mixed feelings about it because it seemed like such a risk. She said she had rules, and she followed her rules. She said some of the men were gross. She didn't seem to have a real problem with sex work existing. I don't know. Una?
Well, the community ever since the 50s has had a problem with trying to get the money for our medical treatments and for our transition, while at the same time being denied employment, being denied health benefits, being denied insurance. So it's a catch 22 almost. You must come up with this money to survive, but we're not going to allow you to earn the money like everyone else. And so you're driven to sex work. My work with the Justice Project of Kansas City, I worked with a lot of sex workers that are on the streets of Kansas City. I never met anyone who said, yes, this is what I want to be in life when I grow up. But at the same time, they also had a very practical attitude about it that I felt was reflected in Janet's book, that it's just a job to do. I had to do it. This is a job that worked. It got me money, and it was a means to an end. And so while she is a little bit almost blasé about it in some ways, maybe that's her way of coping with it, too.
You know? Well, and I've had to compartmentalize my life. I understood a little better when she said when she was a student, she was strictly a student. That's who she was. And then at night, she had her job. Mm-hmm. And I went, a completely different type of job, but I've done that where I've had to compartmentalize. Now I'm a mom. Now I'm an editor. Samantha?
You know, she talks about that, you know, sex work, it's work, you know, it's people that have, you know, not just hormones, but food. It's not always about providing for your transition, it's about survival. You know, some of the things that she talks about have to do with, you know, some of the violence towards transgender women of color. But one of the things I liked about her book, just in general, how she would talk about her memoir and talk about her life, and then she would equate that into her views on social justice, on, LGBTQIA issues. Of the world, even today. I mean, it's only 3 years old, but it really talked to a lot of the struggles that and the pains that trans women of color have. You know, with all of the violence that alluded to, almost over 50% of LGBTQIA violence that's reported is against trans women of color. And then you look on the other side of it. When you look at some of the other statistics, only 10% of hate crimes reported are about trans women of color. So there's some disparities that we need to dismantle and reconstruct, because it's whatever we're doing is not working.
Very true. Anne?
Yeah, I agree, particularly in the way she we're talking about trans women of color. There are times in the book where she even steps away from the trans aspect just to address women of color in society as a whole, and how sometimes, especially since she's a mixed descent, how she is read, how society perceives her is important. And I think in terms of sex workers and that kind of thing, if she had just sort of set it aside and said, well, I did it, but I got through it, and didn't really go into detail, I think she is leaving out something that more of us need to be aware of, and need to be aware of the reasons why, because it's so easy to just say, well, make a different choice, or don't do that. I think a lot of people come to that from a place of judgment. So I think the fact that she did address it, I also felt that it was a step removed emotionally, more than I expected it to be, some of those passages. But I think it goes to your point about compartmentalization. I think that's how she survived that. So now looking back through, she's going, okay, let me just look at this as an incident in my life, or not an incident, but a series of events and choices. And she doesn't shy away from them, but she doesn't necessarily get really emotionally nitty-gritty about it either. And I think she does need that distance. We all do sometimes from difficult experiences in our lives, or choices we've made, that when we take it apart later, you need that distance. But I'm glad she put it in the book, because I think it's something, especially for trans women of color, that just gets glossed over. And the finances and what those money concerns, or even just health concerns, can present women with as a choice.
Her honesty was admirable. And she was on a show recently, I believe it was radio, I don't know if it was a host or a guest, it was in the national news, said, I'd kill a woman if I found out about her. And her response was, if you think trans women should disclose and be honest, then why don't you work on making the damn world safe for us to exist in the first place? And I thought that was
bravo.
It's analogous to Taylor Swift, and I wouldn't have expected it to be her. The lawyers, the groping assault charge, the case, they said, well, you ruined this man's career. No, I didn't. He made a choice, and it led to what happened. And someone else said, well, your dress isn't up in the front. She goes, well, that's because he was reaching around back. I think it's important sometimes to just say strongly, this is who I am. There was one term, I didn't have a problem with it when I read the book, because I didn't get it. I can be kind of gullible. But I read after the sex workers in the book and in the bars, they would say, oh, you're looking so fish. And I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. But in researching and reading, it refers to women's bodies as, well, having an odor. And I understood that maybe back then when she was very young, she wouldn't have known. Everybody's saying it. You don't think anything about it. But I have a bit of a problem that now she's older. She's 34, and not saying this was a term I wouldn't use now or something. Any reactions? It's a term I bristle at.
I don't think I ever came across her using it in any other context other than when she was quoting someone in the past. And in interviews, I found a couple of criticisms online, and I saw a short interview where the term came up, and it's really definitely a term that she does not herself use nor endorse. I think that she was just more reporting accurately on,
climate.
Yes.
I agree.
Important distinction. Anne?
Yeah, I was familiar with the term. I've heard it used on television and shows, so I knew what it meant. I didn't have to go looking for it. I agree. It's not exactly how I would like that connotated for myself personally, but I got a sense from the book that it was more reportage. This is the language being used. This is the word. So I didn't take offense at it or have any problem with it that way.
We're running out of time, so what I'd like to do is go around, and if there's anything you'd like to say it, and I'd love to know what project you're doing right now that you're particularly proud of. And we'll start with Samantha.
One of the things that we even touched on today is that our sexual identity, we don't necessarily become aware of until, well, later in life, certainly after, towards puberty and towards, growing up and figuring all that out. When it comes to gender identity, those are things that do come a lot earlier in life. She knew that there was, she didn't quite have the label for it, but she knew that, she didn't necessarily want to ride the bike, didn't necessarily want to have the buzz cut, didn't want to have this, and didn't necessarily know why, but she started knowing very early on, that her gender identity was incongruent with her her body. And that's one thing I want to remind everyone, that gender and sexuality are not related, although there may be some intersections. They are certainly different.
Thank you. Una?
The thing that really strikes me is that even though she started writing the book, I believe, in 2011 from notes, and the book was actually published in 2014, is that the social dynamics of transgender and gender in society have moved so rapidly and in so many different directions that the book almost read like one of the historical biographies that I've collected of transgender persons. I think I was just struck by how her experience and the way she speaks about gender is already a half step in the past. And it just points, not that there's anything wrong with it, but it just points to how rapidly this entire phenomenon evolves.
And I had a slightly different reaction. I heard her speak last year and had pegged her as older than she is. She's so mature. And so when she was talking about Beyonce and Janet Jackson
and the drag movement in the late 90s.
Yeah,
and
PlayStations. I was shocked to find that she's really the age of my son, because she seems to have lived more of a life. Anne, what about you?
The thing I was struck by reading it, and I told my wife at one point, you know, I think what people consider stereotypical society, you know, in terms of feminine, if you read her voice as a child in that book and what she was thinking about, she was more stereotypically feminine, regardless of what she was assigned at birth.